This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
If you're thinking about GLP-1s for weight loss, listen up. You must make sure you're maintaining your muscle mass while you're losing weight. Otherwise, you can slow your metabolism and regain the weight. Omisid, a natural superfood protein shake, has been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. It optimizes and supercharges your metabolism so you can lose weight easily. Use Omisid with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at omised.com. That's AlmaSed.com.
The details behind the Diddy indictment, Taylor Swift's stalkers, Jerry Lee trying to kill Elvis. Disgraceland dives into the dark side of entertainment every Tuesday. Follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tommy's out today. I'm in. Glad to be with you for the next 4 hours here on WWL. Hey, I love Family Feud no matter who's hosting. One person texts us. Another person says the floor on Fox is pretty interesting. Yeah, I asked with the 10,000th episode of The Price is Right airing today, what is your favorite game show, hearing from some people that it is The Price is Right? We'll keep that thread going throughout the morning here on WWL. But right now we want to turn our attention to the federal government, to the Trump administration, and to the big cuts that we keep hearing that have already come and more are on the way to the federal government. To help us understand what's going on and why, we got political scientist at the university, at Indiana University, Aaron Dusso, to join us. Morning, Professor.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad you could be here. Cabinet meeting, but a non-cabinet member was there and talking about everybody better find ways to do some big old cutting in the federal government. What's on the horizon for the Trump administration in terms of cutting the federal government?
I mean, the cuts, one of the big things that's happening right now with the Trump administration is his ability to get a budget resolution through Congress so that Congress can enact not only cuts to the budget, but also raise money, particularly for the ICE and the Border Patrol, which right now is in, you know, needs a, you know, $100 to $150 billion in order to be able to continue its operations. So right now they need money as much as they need cuts.
So is that what this really comes down to? Is Elon Musk telling the department heads and the cabinet members and the public through his appearances with his bedazzled chainsaw that all of this money is going to be saved by the federal government so that they can deport illegal immigrants?
Well, I mean, the money that the DOGE department is saying that it's cutting are really situations where the president is using an empowerment ability to take money that was allocated by Congress to these various departments and committees to conduct some type of you know, it might be the USAID in order to, you know, engage in some type of programs in Africa to help sick children. It's what it's doing is just saying you're not going to spend that money anymore, and so we're going to hold it. The money's still there; it's just being held. So the cuts don't really come until Congress does it, and that's why Congress becomes a key player in this.
Yeah, a lot of people have wondered where is the legislative branch of government in all of this, and that's an interesting perspective that you shed some light on, the fact that this money being saved is not available for the Trump administration to spend because Congress earmarked it for these programs. But if the federal government doesn't spend it, if the White House stops that spending, it'll sit in those accounts and turn into a surplus, and then Congress can decide what to do with it.
Right. I mean, this is the way it has historically acted. Obviously, the Trump administration has shown its willingness to think creatively, I would say, about how things are going to work. And one, you know, action they theoretically could take is to try and actually start moving money around that hasn't been earmarked specifically by Congress. Now, again, that wouldn't be that would be a new activity for a president to do. And it's not clear exactly how Congress would react or even the courts would react. So we might enter that kind of world soon if Congress can't pass money, particularly for Border Patrol and ICE and mass deportations.
$150 billion? Was that the number you said that the administration wants to do these mass deportations and to track down all these illegal immigrant criminals in the country?
I've seen different numbers. Somewhere between $100 and $150 billion is what they're asking for right now, and that's to be included in this next budget.
We're seeing activity already, and we're hearing anecdotally that illegal border crossings are down. We have seen some plane loads of illegal immigrants who the administration says had committed other criminal acts while in the United States have been tracked down and deported. But you expect that activity to pick up and dramatically?
I would assume, again, it all depends on money. Obviously, you have to be able to pay these agents and ICE agents that are going to go around to do this in the flights that are going to fly to whichever country they're going to go to or Guantanamo. So all that costs money, particularly setting up detention centers within the United States, again, money. And so that money needs to be found somewhere. And if Congress doesn't allocate it, perhaps the next step for the administration would be to try and move it from some other department that supposedly they have closed.
We're talking to Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis, Aaron Dusso. When we come back, I want to ask him, is what we're seeing out of the White House now what Trump supporters voted him into office to do? I did hear a lot of folks before the election saying we need to stop spending money overseas, helping rebuilding other countries we've destroyed or helping other nations that have nothing to do with the United States and use that money to help people here at home. Is that what we're seeing? Is it reaction to that sentiment? Why is the Trump administration working so hard and so publicly to cut so much money from the federal budget? Is this what his voters wanted? We'll ask Professor Dusso that after we check on WWL traffic. Elon Musk is taking a very public, central role in the Trump White House. Is this what voters wanted when they overwhelmingly elected Donald Trump to return to Washington? Aaron Dusso, an associate professor of political science at Indiana University, Indianapolis, is our guest. Professor, are we seeing out of the Trump administration what the MAGA Republicans wanted?
I mean, I think it depends on the terminology we use. If we use kind of that generic, you know, cuts to spending, then yes, absolutely. I think that a vast majority of Trump voters were looking for cuts to the federal government spending, no question. The difference is though, that's a generic term with no specifics. And so once you actually get in office, you have to cut very specific programs. And that's where the you know, mud hits the fan here. And that is the problem that I think the Trump administration is running into right now, when we have to actually have to cut Medicaid, we have to actually cut Medicare, we actually have to cut Social Security. That's when people have particular problems.
Do you envision big cuts coming to those marquee programs that have for so many generations been political no man's land? You just don't cut those programs. Do you think that we will see the Trump White House actually have substantial reductions in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security?
I think that based on the budget resolution that was just passed by the House yesterday, I think there's going to have to be some type of cuts to Medicaid, if not Medicare, in that process. Now, reconciliation process can't include cuts to Social Security, so that's off the table right there. But certainly, in order to overcome the $4.5 trillion in tax cuts that they're proposing, they're going to have significant major spending cuts, and that's going to come from mandatory spending for things like Medicare.
We're hearing anecdotally already about federal employees who have been impacted by this first round of cuts. We know another and probably much larger second round of cuts is on the way as Elon Musk continues to lead this DOGE process. Is there the potential, as we see now, some Trump supporters being impacted by this who maybe didn't realize that they would lose their jobs or their programs that they like, that we do see some Republicans, maybe not all in step with the Trump administration throughout Congress and in the Senate?
Well, I think it's not a very real likelihood that you're going to have certain Republicans that are seeing such complaints from their districts and their states that they're going to say, okay, we can't continue to do this. And I think the most likely place we're going to see that change is going to be happening with the very budget process that's going to be happening over the next year in Congress, where in the fall, they're going to have to make final decisions on these cuts. And I think in the fall, we're going to have a lot different political environment than we have right now. As the Trump administration's approval rate has continued to dip, it's likely they'll be underwater by the fall. And at that point, the Trump administration loses a lot of its leverage.
You're already seeing that trend? I mean, is the honeymoon already over? Are we already seeing the approval numbers that rocketed Donald Trump back to the White House start to level off?
Oh, yeah. Now, yeah, we're already seeing it. So it peaked at just about under 50%. And at this point, you know, he was about 8 to 9 points above water when it comes to approval rating. At this point, he's dropped down to about a 48% approval rating, with only about, you know, his disapproval going significantly up, where he's only about 1% above water. And so it's likely within the next month or a few weeks, even, he'll probably dip below, be underwater when it comes to approval rating. And that didn't happen to the Biden administration until the end of August of his first year. So this is happening much quicker than it did under Biden.
Why do you think that is? Why are we so quickly seeing that overwhelming support that put him into the White House starting to drop?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's the press coverage of what the Elon Musk and his Doge department are doing. It's not being seen as positive, particularly with all the stories of people, you know, thousands of people being thrown out of work. That just rarely plays well, even among people who voted for him to make cuts to the federal government.
Donald Trump, this is the end of the line for him. He can't run again. There's no other political office for him to seek after this. Does he care?
Well, that's one of the things about a lame duck. Seemingly, you don't have to care, although there is ways that the president maybe could find his way back in office in 4 years.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, one option would be he runs as vice president and has his son run as president. And then the son, once he is elected, he resigns from office and then he becomes president again.
Would that be constitutional?
As far as the Constitution, that seemingly would be, yeah.
All right, Professor Dusso, what an interesting way to leave the discussion. Thanks for joining us here on WWL. Have a great day. It's news time. Coming up after the news, we'll be talking about what happens if the Pope dies. 6:45 on your Wednesday morning, February the 26th, 2025, the last Wednesday of the month. It's going to be March before you know it, but we've got a little bit of parading, partying, and celebrating to do before then, as Fat Tuesday is coming up just 6 days away. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. The Pope has been hospitalized in critical condition. We're hearing various reports about how well or not well he's been doing, but it had us wondering, since it's been a while since we've had a new Pope, how the process will work when it is time to find the next pope. So we asked Joelle Rollo Costner to join us, a professor of medieval history at the University of Rhode Island and specialist of the late medieval papacy in the Avignon in Rome. Good morning. How are you, Professor?
Good morning. And how are you?
I'm doing well. We're in the midst and throes of Mardi Gras here, and we've got parades every day and every night until Fat Tuesday. So.
Yeah, I'm French, so I know everything about Mardi Gras.
Well, come on down. There's still a few rooms available here or there if you need some place to stay.
That'll work.
The Pope has been hospitalized, and it has people wondering about the process now.
Sure.
When was the last time we had a new Pope? How long have we had this Pope?
I think that he was elected in 2013. So what? It's like 12 years? What's interesting, there is a tradition, a very old tradition, which states that very few popes have lasted over what is called St. Peter's years, which means over 25 years. And I think the one of the most recent would have been John Paul II. But also, I was listening to Italian news before I talked to you guys. And so he had a couple of, I think like three CT scans of his lungs. So he's pretty stable. I mean, he's not out of the woods. And I don't know if you saw any pictures, but he was quite swollen. So he may not be gone yet. I think he's a fighter, but it's kind of, we will see. But in any case, he has been ruling. He has been Pope for something like 12 years.
All right, yeah.
So last one, 2013.
And of course, it would be, since popes tend to be older men,
yep.
It would be very unusual to see a pope last for 25 years like Pope John Paul
yes.
II did.
Yes, and actually I have a funny example. So the Avignon Papacy is when the popes resided in France throughout the 14th century. And there is one pope elected called John the 22nd, and he's elected in 1316, if I remember.
Yeah, you remember it well, 1316.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I don't, it's my specialty. He's elected because he's like in his 70s. So everybody, you know, the College of Cardinals think, well, you know, he's old, he's not going to last a long time. And the irony that he lived up to his 90s, I mean, in the 14th century, that's, you know, not very common. And not only did he live in his 90s, but he's one of the biggest reforming popes that we have in the Middle Ages, because he really created a solid administration. He centralized taxation and everything. So sometimes old men can accomplish amazing things.
And Francis has been widely regarded as a popular pope, but he has not done anything overwhelmingly significant when it comes to changing church policies or reform, has he?
So it's interesting because there is a tendency to treat Francis as a very modern, very progressive. You know, the church is a little bit like politics in any countries or in any democracies, where you have a progressive side and you have a traditionalist side. And Francis has always been considered on the progressive side. I mean, he did things like which caused him lots of issues with the traditionalist side, is that he proposed a blessing for same-sex people. He proposed a blessing for, like, divorcees. And then there was some recanting, saying, well, you know, a blessing is not a benediction. So I think that he has tried. He has been one of the first one, if not the first pope, to address climate change. He has a papal letter saying that we need to take care not only of our spirits, but we also need to take care of our planet. So, I mean, he has tried to live with his time, but I think he's also realizing, you know, you have to do politics when you are at the Vatican also. And I think that he realized that there is somewhat of a large group, very traditional, who does not want to see this. So, listen, I am not inside the Vatican because I am a woman, so I would never be allowed to be inside.
Well,
you know,
never say never, but currently not allowed.
Well,
sure.
I never say never, but for the past, 2,000 years, it has not happened, so...
I'm going to pause you right there because we got to get to a little traffic update and take a break. And then when we come back, we'll continue this conversation should we expect out of the next pope. If this pope has been progressive, even though he has not done anything permanently to change church policy, there have been some controversial moves by this pope. Will the next pope continue that direction, or do we expect a return to somebody more conservative? And how does the process work? We'll review that after this on WWL. Good morning, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. We're talking about the Pope. Pope Francis, 88 years old, has been the Pope for a dozen years and has been in the hospital now for 12 days, battling chronic lung disease and bronchitis. But he was sitting up today receiving therapy, and his prognosis remains, at least for now, pretty positive that he is making progress. A CT scan of his lungs has showed that he is not, at this point, suffering from something that will kill him immediately. Nonetheless, we're talking about what happens when it is time to select the next pope. Joel Rollo Koster is our guest, professor of medieval history at the University of Rhode Island. You were talking about how this has been a pretty progressive pope in Francis. Do you think that when the cardinals select his replacement, they will want someone who is as or more progressive? Or, as we've seen in political circles historically, after a progressive individual, often we see a return to someone more conservative?
So I had that conversation with a journalist, and I said, you know what? I think it's going to follow what's going on in elections all over the world. Basically, if you look at the College of Cardinals, so we have something like 250 cardinals. I don't have the exact numbers, but it's around that. Of the 250 cardinals, somewhat, you have you are not allowed to participate in the vote if you are over 80 years old. So that gives us down to something like 130 cardinals. And if you look at the composition of that voting college, you realize that the majority would go towards a traditionalist. So that would be a group of cardinals which does not really like the way Francis has been going, which would like to go back to things like, you know, the mass in Latin, or, you know, stop blessing several groups of people. But what is interesting is that Pope Francis has anticipated what could happen. And what he has been doing is that what I would call stacking the college, meaning that he has nominated in consistories several, I mean, something like 60% of the College of Cardinals has been named by Francis. So I'm assuming the strategy here is to think that, after all, Francis nominated me, so I'm going to vote like his policies. On the other hand, once Francis is gone, you can also assume that people will vote whatever they want without, you know, thinking, oh, I owe Francis a vote, which would be a progressive vote.
Thank you, Professor. We're running out of time. We appreciate it. When he does die, the Cardinals will convene and we'll see what happens then. Arthur Hardy joins us after the news. Oh, it's definitely carnival time. I just finished the last of those peanut butter patty cookies from the Girl Scouts, and folks are texting me the things that they cannot resist, that if you open a pack, a bag, a box of them, you eat them all. One person says, it's the Mr. Beast peanut butter filled chocolate bar. All right, that's Tim in Master Control. Somebody else says jelly beans. Dong Fong almond king cake. I eat it all. And somebody else says Hershey's sour cream baking chips mixed with Hershey's dark chocolate baking chips. Greatest snack candy ever created. Keep the text coming at 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Jewelers Talk and Text line as we welcome in Arthur Hardy, the founder of the Mardi Gras Guide. Happy carnival, sir.
Happy carnival, and for me, it's boiled crawfish. Can't eat just one. I have to complete whatever's in front of me, and maybe whatever's in front of my wife, too. Whatever she doesn't eat, I'm having them.
So how many pounds do you think you eat at a normal crawfish boil?
I know I've done 10, and I would have continued, except they ran out of crawfish.
All right. Yeah, I can do 5. That's about my limit. Then my fingers hurt,
it's fatigue. Kinda, yeah.
But if it's late in the season and they're good and calloused up, maybe I could go for 7 pounds. So
there you go.
All right, Arthur. We had bonus parades last night because of Sunday's rain, and it was floats only. How did that go over with the crowd in Uptown New Orleans?
I've heard kind of mixed reviews, but in general, I think it went well. And, you know, when you think about it, a week from today is Ash Wednesday. All that's going to happen between now and then. I did a little checking here. We've had 22 of the major parades already happen. We've got 34 within the next week. So the best is yet to come in terms of size and you know, quantity and quality. So, you know, just get ready. The weather looks good, and I don't think there's any stopping us now.
Yeah, and that's the key. There is probably not going to be. There's like a 20% chance of rain Thursday, but probably before parades, and now it's looking like any rain Fat Tuesday will be after parade, so there's nothing to impede the processions, and that's got to be great news for these crews because, you know, it's sad when you see all of the time, effort, and money spent on these parades, from the float builders to the themes that are determined a year in advance, to everything that is purchased, all of the dues that are paid, all the dancing teams that practice, all the bands that get ready, and everything else.
You got it.
And then they can't parade. So while we had Sunday's rain and the dance teams and the bands didn't get to perform last night, everything else looks like it's a go.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And I'm really looking forward to all. You know, I heard our police superintendent talk about enforcement of the rules, and I certainly take her at her word. I like her a lot. I think she's doing a terrific job. I can tell you they weren't enforced on Saturday, or at least if there was, I didn't see it. I counted 51 canopies on Napoleon Avenue from Magazine Street to St. Charles Avenue. Now, I didn't see one tent. Now, I don't know if that means people just decided not to bring tents, or maybe I missed the police picking those up. I don't know. But so far, I haven't seen a lot of enforcement. And it's, you know, it's such a hard thing to do logistically and I guess even philosophically, you know. But I take her at her word. So we're going to see. They certainly have enough manpower now to do that, and that's always been an issue. But I know on Fat Tuesday, there's so many open flame containers and tents and you know, wall to wall from Claiborne Avenue to Harmony Circle. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of examples of what now, I guess, is illegal.
And that's the big change this year, is no more canopies, no more barbecue pits, no more grills, no more boiling pots, nothing with an open flame. And we have heard conflicting reports on how much enforcement will be done. Also on the rules about lining up more than 3 or 4 hours before a parade, we've been told there are going to be more enforcement of those rules as well. Do all of these new rules, do you think, they're designed, obviously, to make it a better parading experience, but there is going to be some conflict and some controversy?
There's no doubt. There's no doubt there's going to be some pushback. And it's a shame. You know, I guess maybe we kind of brought this on ourselves, but who can ever say hell with safety? You know, of course we all want a safe Mardi Gras. So we'll see how it washes out, but I just don't think we could ask for better weather. 70 degrees for highs from now to Fat Tuesday. I mean, my goodness, it's been a long time since we've had that. So I'm looking forward to it. I've got to try to get my energy up here. And you know, it is a marathon, not a sprint, right?
And we're talking with, you better be ready for that marathon. But it seems like a series of small sprints amongst the marathon. Talking with Mardi Gras Guide founder Arthur Hardy. When we come back, we'll find out what is new for any of the crews this year and what you may experience differently at this year's Mardi Gras, as we'll ask him what to expect the rest of the way as we go all the way to Fat Tuesday with parades every day here on WWL. Arthur's back after we check on WWL traffic. 7:25, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker, and the Mardi Gras Guide founder Arthur Hardy is joining us this morning. Arthur, folks are talking about, you know, I told you the Girl Scouts sent over some cookies and I ate all 15 of the peanut butter patties in no time flat. Other people say for them, they cannot stop eating Russell Stover's solid chocolate Easter bunnies, fun size Reese's or Snickers. The whole bag is just gone. Another person says Thin Mints from the freezer, Jaffa Cakes, original crispy Cheetos, Haydel's traditional king cake. And somebody else says French fries are my weakness. I eat them all with ketchup. So,
hey, what about Heavenly Hash? Heavenly Hash made by the Elmer's
Gold Brick
Company.
Eggs.
Yeah.
Yes.
Stop.
Yeah, I'm gaining weight just thinking about it.
Yep.
Maybe way to lose weight is to go to parades and walk the routes and participate and have fun.
There you go.
Although then you catch moon pies and chiwis and everything else that they throw to eat from the floats. And I eat all that stuff at the parades as well. So there is that.
Yeah, well, the diet starts on Ash Wednesday, right?
Sure. Because St. Patrick's Day is right afterwards. So that.
There you go.
Then we're having corned beef. That's another discussion for another day. Let's get through Fat Tuesday first. So we talked about the rule changes. Anything else that people will experience differently taking part in Mardi Gras festivities between now and Fat Tuesday this year?
I think you'll see less plastic, you know, the move towards eco-friendly, environmentally safe, locally produced products is really taking hold. Rex has a sustainable package issue with six different items in it, and many other crews are doing that. And I think that's a healthy movement. And then I think you're going to see continued interest in crew signature throws. I mean, people don't want just generic throws. They want something with the crew's name on it. Light-up throws are always big. And now we've gotten to the point where float-specific throws, you know, I want one from each float. So it drives collectors nuts because how do you get one from every float? If you miss float three, you'll never have a complete set. So do you run down the street and get – I mean, it's a job. It's
yeah,
become a
and
job.
And if you miss it, you'd then go way down to the parade route and catch the whole parade again to get the float-specific throws that you missed. You know, I still see the doubloon dudes out there with their little boxes on the stick asking for doubloons. But do many – crews even make doubloons at this point?
Yeah, well, more than you think. It's had a little bit of a comeback, and they have these cutout doubloons now, which are not circular. You know, they have a particular shape, and that's, you know, caused a little bit of a resurgence in interest, but not like it once was. And of course, we've got some great celebrities this year with Shaquille O'Neal as Bacchus, Katy Perry as the entertainment for Endymion, and then Bianca Del Rio and Brothers Osborne will entertain at the Orpheus Escapade after the Orpheus Parade in Lindegore. So that's always nice. And, you know, it just looks like a really good year. Other than that rainout, which we recovered from, you know, it's just a good stretch of good things, we hope, right?
Yeah, you know, what I've noticed more than anything is, and I don't know if it's a sustainability push or what, but fewer and fewer beads, and more beads laying on the ground if they are thrown.
Yep.
It seems that they really do want these unique and different throws. But even I noted Friday night at Cleopatra, some of the stuff laying on the ground at Cleopatra would have been some of the most attractive throws in years past.
Yep.
Even the light-up Blinky Cleo headbands, there were so many thrown that people were leaving them on the ground at some point.
Yeah, it's an embarrassment of riches. There's another thing people notice along the New Orleans parades. The Red Cross has really beefed up their presence at parades. They've always been there, but now they have more units, and they're doing outreach to the first responders, providing food and drinks and you know, hand wipes and whatever they need along the parade route. So that's good to see. And, you know, what can you say about the police and EMS and the job these people do? I understand there was an incident last night at Gallia Hall in the Carrollton Parade where someone had some health issue and they stopped the parade, and EMS got up there and took the gentleman off on a stretcher. Hopefully he's okay. But they act so quickly, you know, and so efficiently, and thank God we have them out there on the parade route, huh?
Thank you, Arthur. We appreciate it. I know you've got a long stretch to finish this marathon. We look forward to hearing your reports throughout the rest of the way through Fat Tuesday. Have a great Mardi Gras.
Thanks, David. Bye-bye.
Mardi Gras guide founder Arthur Hardy here on WWL. We'll talk with the Director of Homeland Security for New Orleans coming up after the news. 7:45 on your hump day, Wednesday morning. Glad I can be with you. Tell me you'll be back tomorrow here on WWL. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, I want to take a deeper dive into this new report that finds in Louisiana, a majority of children are now born to parents who are not married. Nearly 55% of all children born in Louisiana now have parents that did not get married. Nationwide in the U.S. and Canada, the numbers are similar in rural areas across North America, that fewer and fewer people are getting married before they have children. So we'll take a deeper dive into that in the 9 o'clock hour. WWL is your home for Mardi Gras Fat Tuesday. Join the crew of WWL for wall-to-wall coverage of the greatest free show on earth. We'll broadcast live from New Orleans and Company on St. Charles Avenue in the heart of the party. The fun starts at 8 a.m. with Tommy Tucker and Linda Cassidy from our sister station, Magic 101.9, followed by Newell Norman and Scoot featuring Ashley O from Bayou 95.7. Catch real-time coverage of Zulu and Rex and all of the sights, sounds, and excitements of Mardi Gras from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Colin Arnold is the New Orleans Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness, and I imagine that this time is so much fun for so many people, but for you, it's a whole lot of work, Colin.
Oh, hey, good morning, Dave. We love it. It's just a different kind of love.
I understand, and you got to love the end result that you are able
That's
to
right.
help the greatest free show on earth go off with so many people having so much fun, with you know the challenges that come with having a million people on the streets partying all at once.
No, for sure. I mean, we get a little bit of a smaller crowd that shows up the first week, but that gives us. Actually is, you know, gives us some time and more locals gives us time to kind of, refine what we've put together and be ready for what's coming towards us, you know, moving on from tonight into certainly the weekend and then Monday and Tuesday.
We've seen the slalom course that some describe as playing Mario Kart on the other side of the parade route on St. Charles Avenue to impede traffic. I mean, obviously, it's designed to slow people down and to make it far more difficult for anyone who wants to do something horrible to do it. And while it's an inconvenience for many, clearly it is a effective impedance to preventing someone from driving a vehicle into the crowd. Obviously, a concern after New Year's Day and other things we've seen around the world. Are there any other stepped up types of security protocols that we will see unfolding as we get closer to the second weekend leading into Fat Tuesday?
Yeah, you know, the serpentine on St. Charles was something that, took a lot of thought. There was a lot of things that we considered, including up to and including closing that side of St. Charles Avenue during the parades. But it just, that became such a logistical nightmare and kind of, we made a commitment to the public that we weren't going to, completely ruin Mardi Gras by making it impossible to get around for residents and others to get to the parades. And so that was a smart compromise that seems to be working well. It's one layer. There's a lot of law enforcement. And to your question, there's a lot of law enforcement, both local and state and federal, behind the parade route and on the off side of the parade route as a second level of if somebody is trying to do something, that would be one thing. We have more aviation assets in the air this year, and we have a much bigger counter-drone operation than we've had in the past, and that came with the SEER 1 program. But we're building up locally a better anti-drone or drone identification works, for future Mardi Gras and future special events, because we realize that, the vehicle-borne threat is one aspect of it, but we are seeing, and you've seen over in Ukraine and other areas, the drone, using drones as a weapon is becoming more significant as well. So we've got a lot of assets for that this year for Mardi Gras.
During Endymion, for example, can people expect similar kinds of situations on the non-parade side of the route where we have not yet had parades this season?
Yeah, I think that is a fair assumption. There will be additional barricades and things out there as well for Endymion.
The fun goes on nonetheless. We heard from New Orleans and company that crowds this year are expected to be even bigger than last year, and last year was the first year that surpassed the pre-pandemic crowd sizes. So by all accounts, we could have record numbers of people celebrating through Fat Tuesday. Are you, the state, and the federal authorities who are for the first time ever treating this as the highest level of national security event ready for those massive crowds and to make sure everyone can have fun despite all the security measures that are now in place?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the security measures have definitely helped us. But, yeah, we're ready. And I know the police department, is all hands on deck. All of our critical agencies are all hands on deck. And the federal presence and state presence has been, obviously noticeable and is going to grow even larger as we move into the weekend.
Talking with Colin Arnold, the New Orleans Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness, as we are 6 days away from Fat Tuesday and the crowds will just keep getting bigger, the parades will getting longer, and the fun gets more intense. When we come back, I'll ask him about French Quarter security and what folks going to Bourbon Street or Royal Street or anywhere else in the quarter may experience differently this year compared to years in the past with this SEER 1 designation. And how much will we see enforcement of the no grills, no barbecue pits, no boiling pots, no canopies, and the other new rules that are in place? How much enforcement will we see? We've heard conflicting reports. Colin Arnold answers all those questions after we check on WWL traffic. 7:56, 4 in front of 8. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Colin Arnold is our guest. Colin, folks heading to the French Quarter for the Bourbon Street festivities or anything else in the Vieux-Carré, what can they expect to be different this year with this higher designation from the federal government of security for Mardi Gras?
If you saw what you saw during Super Bowl is pretty much going to be the standard for Mardi Gras coming up this weekend as well. You know, and that includes that interior and exterior closure of Bourbon Street and kind of the French Quarter, you know, the pedestrian area, to where, you know, unless you have a reason with a vehicle to be down there, I wouldn't even try and bring a vehicle down into the French Quarter. You know, obviously, allowances will be made for hotels, for deliveries, for the businesses, and for obviously public safety vehicles. But other than that, there really should not be anybody coming down there and by vehicle. Walk your way in and walk your way out, and I think it'll actually save you time and probably headache with, you know, people trying to get in that have no purpose of being there. You know, people from out of town that may not know. But that closure is going to be pretty. You know, is going to be strictly enforced. And then, you know, also the Frenchman Street area, Jackson Square and the like, you know, similar barriers and things like that.
And people should not be surprised if authorities ask to check their bags or to inspect what they're carrying, and particularly if they're bringing an ice chest or a cooler.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, those types of things, we have to go with what the threat is, and we want to make sure that everyone is safe.
We've heard a lot, and it was, you know, major headline news a year ago when we first learned, or a little less than a year ago, that there was going to be a ban at this year's Mardi Gras on those canopies that people love to set up, on the barbecue pits, on the grills, on the boiling pots, on so many things so many people like to bring to the parade routes. We've heard conflicting reports on how much enforcement we're going to see. What are you advising that authorities do to enforce or to work with the crowd when it comes to these new bans?
Yeah, this is a difficult one because, you know, we do realize that the resources that we have are finite. You know, we cannot be everywhere all the time. I think Chief Kirkpatrick, you know, kind of laid it out well when she really asked and pleaded for the crowds to work with us on this. I mean, I'm going to be honest. Some of these things are obviously quality of life issues for the parade goers, but a lot of them have been built really during this administration since 2019. We've been building on some of the regulations based on what we've seen from some of the threats that are out there. And, you know, a propane tank can do a lot of damage accidentally, let alone if somebody was trying to do that intentionally. And the tent situation just became a little bit out of control with not being able to see behind them what people were doing. And those things are actually go beyond just quality of life. So my suggestion is follow the law and leave them off. You know, I appreciate the council working with us on a lot of these regulations over the years and giving us the NOPD the latitude to talk about enforcement. But if there's a situation that needs to be enforced, it will be enforced. So I think that asking for the public's assistance and helping us with this is, you know, what I would say is my goal. And that is, you know, don't bring those things out there because they are a danger to the public. And, you know, and they do have the potential as well to be a quality of life issue. People can't see the parade from behind these tents, the couches.
Thank you, Colin. We appreciate it. Got to run. Have a great Mardi Gras. All right, we're in the long marathon to Fat Tuesday now that sometimes feels like we're sprinting through it as we have parades every day now through Mardi Gras Day. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Ronald Surpass is a former NOPD chief, now professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. Good morning, sir.
Hey, how are you today, Dave?
Good. How's your Mardi Gras going so far?
Yeah, pretty good. I've always loved it every day since I was a kid, all the years I was on the police department. It's just one of the greatest things about living in New Orleans.
How is it different for you now as a father, a grandfather, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. To get to go to the parades and enjoy everything rather than having to walk a beat or responsible for a block or oversee the entire NOPD response. What's a Mardi Gras parade like for you now?
mean, that's funny you say it that way, because what made Mardi Gras so special as a teenager or as a police officer was to see the eyes of the people enjoying the parades. And that's what I saw when I worked for the police department. It was just watching people having such a good time, overseeing the entire department for 4 Mardi Gras, being the number 2 chief for 6 Mardi Gras, and working horses and riding motorcycles and walking a beat on Bourbon Street. Those are unique experiences that not very many people in the world have, and I share it with those of the department who did it when I did it after me, and it's just wonderful. I can't say enough about it. It's great.
How challenging do you think it will be for the NOPD and all the other out-of-town resources that have come in from other departments, other sheriff's offices, along with the state and federal folks in town, to keep this Mardi Gras safe in light of what we saw on New Year's Day, plus with all of these new regulations banning canopies and tents and barbecue pits and grills and boiling pots and all that?
Well, there's a couple ways of looking at it. One is the city having half the number of police officers we had just 8 years ago makes it incredibly difficult. And there's a whole history of how we got here that's very unfortunate. Secondly, the collaboration among the different law enforcement agencies, state, federal, and local, has always been well done, and I am sure it will continue to be well done. Third, I got to be honest with you. You might remember, Dave, my first Mardi Gras back, Mardi Gras of 11, I did a press conference and said, look, folks, we're not going to let this opportunity missed to tell you, please don't bring your kitchen table to the neutral ground. Please don't bring your bedroom set to the neutral ground. Please don't bring all this stuff to neutral ground. And guess what? They did it then. They did it for 30 years before I made that announcement. And I suspect they're going to keep doing it because it's the nature of the city's community and how it celebrates. So it's on the one hand for the council and others to say, we're going to give you all this authority to remove this stuff. I think that authority has always been there, but the question is, what's the balancing act with the community?
And it's got to be a very difficult balancing act. And I get that some people hate that other people are bringing their couches and their grills and their boiling pots and their canopies and their scaffolding and everything else. But for other people, that's the tradition that their family has had for generations. And there seems to be two very different lines of thought about what you should and shouldn't bring. And are there the resources, the time, or the necessity even to really try and change that?
Well, first off, I don't know what resources and time you would have to be removing people's personal property, and where would you put it, and how would you safeguard it, and all those questions. Secondly, the nature of the parade route outside of the French Quarter, and you might agree with me, Dave, outside of the French Quarter, it's the same families in the same blocks year in and year out. And we used to try to put the same police officers in the same blocks year in and year out. And third, how is this much different from a tailgate? Of course, the tailgate's done in a parking lot, but they have the tailgates on Poitras Avenue by the interstate. So I think at the end of the day, everybody wants this to be safe. And the way it's the most likely to be safe is because the crowd is having what they're seeing as an opportunity to share the experience of Mardi Gras that their parents did, that their grandparents did, that their children did. And I'm not being obtuse to the fact that there can be dangers, but you know, there's a lot of things government can tell people to do, but when people decide this is what their culture is, look at the accommodations that are made for the Mardi Gras Indians, because it's such a cultural artifact. There are tons of accommodations are made for their practice of Mardi Gras, just like the people on the Mardi Gras parade route. I think we always want safety to be the primary issue, but a lot of people looking out for each other during a wonderful event can also help to safety.
Yeah, I got to imagine that there will be some conflicts. There will be some situations where people's personal effects are thrown into the back of a garbage truck and crushed, and there's going to be some anger over that. But by and large, I think they're just asking people to curtail what they bring, and we'll see if that happens. We'll continue our conversation about Mardi Gras safety with Ronald Surpass and the Homeland Security aspects of it after this. I also want to ask him about the fact that there have only been 2 murders in the city of New Orleans in February, and we're 26 days into the month. This is unprecedented. We'll get his thoughts on that after we check on WWL traffic. Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker, talking with Ronald Surpass, former NOPD chief, now professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. Chief, we have seen a crime spiral downward like I have not seen in my 30 years of covering crime in New Orleans. You have even more time observing crime trends in the Crescent City. Do you remember any month ever that there were only two homicides in the city of New Orleans. That's all we've seen. In fact, in the last 28 days, there have only been two murders in New Orleans. Last year, there were 12 over the same time. That's an 83% decrease.
Yeah, to be honest with you, that's great news, and it's always good for our community. And yes, I have seen months like that in the past in New Orleans. I think it's this too, Dave. If any police chief or any mayor or governor or president could stop murders on their own initiative, by their own direction, we would have no murders in the country. So there's a combination effect here. There's some things that are going on, we hope and we believe, that the police department, the prosecution system, and all those people working together can help us do something. But sometimes it's just going to be the nature of the people who are involved in that kind of a dangerous lifestyle. This might surprise you, Dave. Less than about one half of 1% of the nation's population is incarcerated in a jail or prison. So we're talking about a very small number of people. And if you look at the data in New Orleans, it's probably going to be very similar. You have about 0.5% of the population that's actually in jail or prison, and you have 2 to 3% that's engaged in any kind of crime at all. So basically, these very small numbers of people can be incredibly hateful and hurtful when they're acting out. But when they're not acting out for reasons that are either because the police and prosecutors have done a better job or the community has done a better job, you can see some dramatic drops.
So there's something else going on, you're saying. It's not just
always
the actions that the police department has taken, not to take away any credit from
right.
the chief or the department. But these numbers are shocking. But you're right. Something must be going on societally amongst the criminal element, because it's not just murders. All shootings are down between 50 and 60% in the city of New Orleans. The number of people shot are down 51% over the last 28 days in the city of New Orleans, and every other major crime category is down. In fact, the only increase over last year is shoplifting. It's up 3%. Burglaries, thefts, auto thefts, aggravated batteries, aggravated assaults, rapes, armed robberies, carjackings, everything else down dramatically.
I'll tell you, all the years that I was a chief and the thousands of community meetings I went to, I learned an early lesson. If I was talking about crime going down, and the public would be very excited and I would be excited, and if I tried to take too much credit for it, the public would remind me immediately when a year later crime went back up, and they would say, well, if you were responsible for it going down last year, why is it going up this year? The problem is you need to be more circumspect. There are so many things. A very bad police department can contribute to crime increase, I absolutely believe. A very good police department can help reduce crime. But there's a lot of other factors going on at the same time. And we're happy. I mean, people in New Orleans should be very happy right now about what's going on with the crime numbers.
Any other thoughts on Mardi Gras as we head into this rush to Fat Tuesday and this first time ever federal designation at the highest level as a Homeland Security event?
New Orleans be New Orleans. Throw me something, mister.
I hope you catch some great stuff. Thank you, Chief Serpas. We appreciate you joining us, as always, here on WWL. Happy Mardi Gras. There he goes. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's going on with all of these aviation mishaps, fatal airline crashes, collisions, near misses, and everything else. Are we seeing an unprecedented number, or are we just suddenly hearing about them more? What is going on? We'll talk about that after the news. Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker on your hump day. Thanks for joining us. It's 8:47 on this February 26th, on our way to wrap up this month and then move into March, all the way to Fat Tuesday, partying all the way. It has been no party for people flying in recent weeks, as we've seen fatal crashes, planes flipping over, near crashes, and other issues. Is it just we're hearing about these things all of a sudden more, or have things become more dangerous for airline passengers? We wanted to know. So we got a professor at the Center for Aviation Studies at Ohio State University to join us, Sean Pruchnicki. Professor, thank you for joining us. You're also a pilot and an accident investigator, so I think you're kind of uniquely qualified to help us understand. After seeing the video of that situation yesterday at Midway Airport in Chicago, where a plane's coming in for landing, and just as its front landing gear touches the runway, another plane moves in front of it. The pilot has to take off again to avoid a crash there. Are these things happening with more frequency now, or are we just suddenly hearing about them more?
Well, thanks for having me, Dave. You know, I tell you, there's a couple different aspects here. One is that, yes, over the last 3 or 4 years, we have had an increase in more near misses. Now, runway incursions, and that's what that is called, a runway incursion, when another aircraft enters the runway, and there's several different reasons that happens. We have seen an increase in those, and they can be pilot-driven or air traffic control-driven is why they happen. And our concern has been the pilot shortage. However, the other component to that is that the awareness, you're exactly right what you mentioned, the awareness has gone up. And people watching airports and cell phones and so forth have been watching and catching more of these. So it's both of these that have brought these to light, especially in light of these accidents. So it's a little bit of both. But we do have a problem in our airspace system, and there is an increase of these events.
Yeah, I want to ask you, you mentioned a pilot shortage. Does that mean that pilots are flying more flights, longer hours with less sleep? Does it mean that people who are less qualified are flying more flights? How does the pilot shortage contribute? And I hate the term near miss, because these are near hits. And that's what I'm more concerned about, is the hits, not the misses. How does a pilot shortage contribute to either more crashes or more incursions where we have situations where they could have been far worse?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. It's actually controller shortages, that it's that we're so short on air traffic controllers. They're the ones that are working longer shifts, less days off. And it's, you know, when you're in those situations that, you know, we have, you become more error prone. You know, and that's understandable, right? In any job, let alone a job that is so difficult already, and one that you basically have to perform perfectly. And very few of us have jobs that you have to perform perfectly on a daily basis.
Yeah, if I make a mistake, and I will point out, and this is a perfect example, you erroneously said pilot shortage a moment ago when you meant air traffic controller shortage. Well, nobody died because you said the wrong thing. If you're an air traffic controller and you do the wrong thing, people could well die. So then the question becomes, as we are seeing increasing numbers of flights and travelers and airport activity, but we have a shortage of air traffic controllers, how do you solve that problem? Do we have to limit the number of flights? Do we have to say we can't see the steady increase if we cannot match that with well-rested, well-trained air traffic controllers to prevent helicopters from flying into the air path of an airplane like we saw in that fatal crash in Washington, D.C., or to prevent one jet from crossing the runway while another jet is landing like we saw yesterday in Chicago, or like we saw all these other incidents that have happened that have been widely reported recently?
Well, it's a multi-pronged approach. One, we have to have more controllers. We need to hire more controllers. And when we do that, we're able to get the work schedules down to where they should be, like they've always been, and they can start meeting those rest limits. The other part of that is the National Transportation Safety Board, who has investigated these incidents over the last three or four years, has made numerous recommendations for things that the FAA and the airspace in general can do that they feel to help reduce the number of incidents. And for various reasons, many of those have not been acted upon. Now, most of us in the industry agree that if this administration in the White House actually wants to do something useful, which we haven't seen them do anything useful yet in this area, is enforce those recommendations, stand behind the NTSB and help the FAA enforce those recommendations, give them the resources they need to say, okay, NTSB, you say that these following things need to happen to prevent these near misses, and you're exactly right. Near miss is not exactly the word. They are near hits. Then let's do that. And some of those have been technology. You're exactly right. It's not just more controllers, but there are some technological advances that can happen to help reduce those. So I don't think necessarily reducing the number of flights are going to be the answer, because there's huge economical impact here. And I don't think that stopping flying is necessarily the answer. It's still extremely safe. And what's unfortunate is these all have happened in a very short period of time. So it does give the appearance that, you know, the sky is falling, so to speak, right? That, you know, everything is disastrous, that we have had an amazing safety record still over a long period of time. But you're exactly right. Some changes need to happen, that our safety margin, although it's still robust, has started to erode even more than it already has over the last 10 years, and we need to put an end to that.
Yeah, and you make a good point. The nature of the beast is that we report the crashes, we report the near hits, we don't report the thousands of flights that take off and land safely every day, and we don't talk about, well, yes, we have seen a few hundred people injured or killed in incidents in the last several weeks. There have been tens of thousands of people who have safely arrived at their destinations without incident. Professor, we appreciate you joining us here on WWL. You still feel perfectly safe taking a flight if you've got to travel?
I did, in fact, just last week. I took 4 flights, and I have a couple next week, and I have no problem doing that.
Thank you, Professor. We appreciate you joining us here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen. We got to get checked up on WWL traffic. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Joe. I'm in for Tommy Tucker, and we started talking about this in the 5 o'clock hour this morning, about this new report on the growing number of children born to unmarried parents. It comes as we're seeing fewer and fewer marriages overall, and now in Louisiana, the CDC says, a majority of children born in this state, nearly 55% of all children born in Louisiana now, have parents who are not married. Nationwide, in the U.S. and Canada, in rural areas, a new report finds that that is also the norm, that nearly 55% of rural births across North America, at least the U.S. and Canada, are to unmarried parents. Why? Why are we seeing fewer marriages, and why are we seeing more children than not born to parents who are not married? To help us understand, we decided to go to the author of the study, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Florida State University, Matt Brooks. Professor Brooks, thank you for joining us here on WWL.
Hi, Dave. Yeah, thanks for having me on, and thanks for finding my report and wanting to talk about it.
Well, what was it that made you and your Canadian cohorts want to do this research, to find out more about birth rates, specifically about children born out of wedlock, amid what we've seen is a trend for many years now of fewer and fewer marriages and more children born to unmarried parents?
Right. Well, there's kind of two reasons behind it. First is that for a number of reasons, we know that children who are born to unmarried parents tend to have worse off, especially like their first few years, than kids who are born to two married parents.
Worse off in terms of what?
I guess you could say that, like, obviously they, on average, grow up, you know, in poorer households. They're stressed related to, you know, the parent having to, you know, balance daycare and balance work. And, you know, maybe, difficulties like, you know, with having the lack of involvement around the parent around education. But I think it's important to note that even when we're talking about, you know, kids born to two not being born to married parents, a lot of kids are still born to two parents that are partners to each other. You know, they're just living together, but they're not formally married. So it's obviously important to just know what the rate is of these kids.
Yeah, when we say unmarried parents, that includes cohabitating parents who, for whatever reason, have chosen not to get married. It also includes single parents who are either raising a child themselves or maybe co-parenting with a parent who does not live in the same household.
Yeah, you're 100% right there. And so beyond the fact that traditionally in the U.S. and in Canada, kids who are, you know, don't live with married parents tend to be worse off in many sorts of ways, we can also kind of view the number of kids born to unmarried parents as kind of a microcosm of a lot of like the economic and social changes we're seeing in the United States. And we specifically in our paper, in our report, look at rural kids because we think that this might be, you know, a really good reflection of like the changing economy and, you know, the changing demographics of the United States and Canada.
Yeah, we know fewer and fewer people are getting married, and we hear anecdotally why that may be. Often it's because they're children of divorce, and they don't want to put their kids through their parents getting a divorce, so they never get married. Maybe it's because weddings are very expensive, and finances have not been good for them lately, and they don't feel like they can afford the wedding of their dreams, so they'd rather not have one at all. Others say it's just a changing approach to cohabitation on our society, that it is far more acceptable now than ever before to not get married and to live together and to even have children together. So how much of it do you think is societal acceptance of unmarried or single parents, and how much of it is something else?
I think instead of maybe societal acceptance of unmarried parents, I think if you're talking about, you know, individuals choosing to and to not to get married and to when to get married, it's much more of, you know, in the past, people viewed marriage as, you know, the start of a relationship. Essentially, you're announcing to your family, your friends, your community, like, hey, we're going to get married because we're going to, you know, start a family together. And now more and more people talk about it in terms of, okay, we're going to get married almost as a celebration of the fact that we have been together. You know, we've been living together for a few years. Maybe we've had our first child. And so it's that flip. And we also know that increasingly more and more people are they're not maybe not necessarily choosing to not get married overall, but they're just delaying marriage. You know, in the 1970s and 80s, we're seeing a lot more people getting married in, you know, their early 20s and mid-20s. And on average, most people today are getting married, you know, at age 30 or 31.
And that's a first marriage.
Yeah, first marriages, of course, you know. Second marriages, you know, people choosing to get married after a divorce is a completely different, you know, set of decisions for people to go through, you know, right?
Absolutely, right. So now we know people are delaying marriage. People are getting married older, if getting married at all. Fewer people overall are getting married. And birth rates have been declining, but clearly not at the same level that marriage rates are declining. So the end result is more children born to parents who are not married, whether they're together or not.
Yeah, that's true. We're definitely seeing this misalignment. And if you're seeing, in the academic research I've done, we're actually seeing that there's been a big, you know, delay in the ages that people are getting married, you know, the shift from, you know, the mid-20s to, you know, the early 30s or even the mid-30s now. But actually, in the same data, we're seeing that the declines from when people start to become parents and, you know, have their first child, that's seen a much less of a change. So most people, if they become parents, are still having their first kid, you know, oftentimes in their mid-20s still.
Yeah, well, the biological clock doesn't stop ticking. So, and that is a finite window in which a woman can conceive and successfully bear a child. So I understand, yeah, delay marriage, but if you delay child rearing, you could potentially run out of time. So I guess the big question is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Or is this just a thing that our society is changing? And we have a majority now of children in our state here in Louisiana, in both rural and urban areas. A majority of all children in Louisiana are now born out of wedlock, nearly 55%. And elsewhere in the United States and across Canada, those numbers are similar, at least for rural areas. What did your research find? I mean, are we seeing a moral decay of society where we're all going to hell in a handbasket and we don't care, so we're just going to conceive children out of wedlock? Or is there something else going on?
I think you should view it as two ways. And, you know, as a professor, as a researcher, we could either view it as like, you know, people are having different morals than they were in the past. They view marriage differently. Their priorities are differently. You know, you maybe could bring in like people's changing religious beliefs into that. And we've actually shown that many people, if you survey them, if you ask them, do you want to get married? They're like, yes, I want to get married. And a lot of people still see a lot of value in marriage and they want to have kids within marriage. But then we can also view this as a, you know, it's a negative thing, because it oftentimes, and the data really reflects this, is this is much more of a reflection of, you know, times are hard for a lot of people. Economic conditions are getting worse. A lot of people are struggling to find jobs. And people are really waiting until, you know, they have that job. They have a successful job. You know, they're like, oh, I want to be in my career for a job for 2 or 3 years. And then maybe I can turn to, you know, having a kid like that. And to be optimistic about whether or not this is a good or bad thing, I think this really just has to do with, as a society, you know, government or, you know, even individual communities or, you know, nonprofits, what we choose to do about this. And I would argue, and my research clearly shows this, is that this is actually not as a bad thing as we've had, because even about 10 years ago, or maybe a little bit less, the Trump administration expanded the tax credits that are offered to families, the child tax credits. And we've actually seen that those have really reduced child poverty rates, and they've reduced child poverty rates significantly for kids who only have one parent. And so if you want to view this as a bad thing morally, that's your own decision. But if it's a bad thing in terms of economics, or if a bad thing, you know, for children's well-being, we have the ability to, you know, mend that through policies or other sorts of efforts.
Do you think that it is a lack of incentivization by the government for people to get married that over the years may have led to this decline in marriage? Do you think it is the whole divorce revolution of the 70s, 80s, and beyond? Is it a combination of those factors? And other people are texting us on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870 that says government incentivizes people to not get married if they have children because they're more likely to get, for example, food stamps.
I would say that is, you know, that's a, to put it bluntly, I think that's a misconception. If you look at the history of, you know, all of our welfare policies in the United States, going back to their founding, you know, the 1960s even, they've really incentivized marriage. Our tax, our tax system really incentivizes people who are married and to file duly. A lot of benefits are only available, you know, a lot of the tax breaks, you know, the earned income tax credit, these child tax credits, they're much larger in terms of dollar amounts to marriage. And so it's not only the United States government has disincentivized marriage, it's much more that, you know, there's a lot of other things that maybe, you know, are coming up in society that are, again, pushing people to maybe not choose marriage. But it's not necessarily because the government is, you know, indirectly incentivizing people to, you know, not get married and to have kids out of wedlock or something like that.
Talking with Matt Brooks, assistant professor of sociology at Florida State University, the co-author of a study that finds increasing numbers of children born in the U.S. and Canada are born to unmarried parents. It's now the majority of children born in rural areas across the country and in Canada. And here in Louisiana, the entire state, nearly 55% of children born in Louisiana now are born to unmarried parents. So it's more normal or more likely that your parents aren't married than that they are when you're born now in Louisiana. I just did a little research. In fiscal year 2023, only 12% of U.S. residents received food stamps. So that means that 88% of U.S. residents do not receive food stamps. So I don't think that's a major player in why people aren't getting married before they have children or aren't getting married at all. We'll continue the conversation, and I welcome your input at 504-260-1870. Call us and text us now on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line and join the conversation. Is it a good thing, a bad thing, or just a thing that a majority of Louisiana children are now born to unmarried parents? And why do you think that is? Let's talk about it here on WWL. New statistics from the Centers for Disease Control show that a majority of children born in Louisiana in recent years were born to unmarried parents. About 55% of all children now born in Louisiana have parents who are not married. Texts are coming in on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870. One person says adult people don't want to put in the time and effort to a marriage. Another says if two people are not married, it's easier for one of them to just walk away. Someone else says divorce is expensive. Somebody else says Medicaid is a big factor as well. Also WIC. These programs look at household income. People don't get married but live together in order to receive the benefits and don't report his income. This person says, I work for WIC. Too many people don't have medical coverage and can't afford it, so they don't get married so they can still get free medical coverage from the government. We're talking with Matt Brooks. He's an assistant professor of sociology at Florida State University and is a co-author of a study that looked at births in the U.S. and Canada and found out that in both countries, in rural areas now, it is a majority of children that are born to unmarried parents. Some factors, Matt, that we talked about: people are getting married later in life but still having children in their 20s, and changing social pressures, no longer universally frowning upon people having children out of wedlock. What else did you find in your research as to why a majority of rural children in the U.S. and Canada, and similarly why a majority of children in all of Louisiana now, are born to unmarried parents?
So, yeah. Additionally, I think the other thing you might need, you know, your viewers might be interested in is that, you know, yes, we're seeing a lot of kids who are still born to unmarried parents, but we see a lot of people still very quickly, you know, choose to get married after having kids. You know, you might refer to this, like, you know, colloquially as a shotgun marriage type situation, but a lot of people are like, okay, if they have a child outside of marriage, they are, you know, still transitioning in into it. And if we're talking about, you know, more specific sorts of factors that might have driven this increase again, it's really that we're seeing a lot more people go to university, go to college. That not only delays your marriage, but it also, you know, puts you on a more economic trajectory where you maybe need to, you know, with student loans, delay having kids, delay having getting married and things like that. And also, when we look to decades past, when, you know, jobs were, you know, a lot better for, you know, the average working class person, that's when we were seeing the highest levels of marriage. So maybe this missing economic base, this economic security is really just making people feel very uncertain about the future, and they're, you know, turning away from marriage.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make. More women than ever before are getting college degrees. More women than ever before are holding positions in the workforce in management and upper levels. And women are the ones who carry and bear children. So as our society changes the way women participate in the workforce, clearly it's going to have impacts on other factors of our society, up to and including if women are married when they have children.
Right. And I think there's two dimensions of that. It's one, you know, to pull a more academic, you know, perspective on it, we would say that, you know, over the past few decades, there has been this increased, you know, acceptance and, you know, pressure and movement of women to, you know, go get jobs, work outside the homes. But women are still, you know, oftentimes expected, even if they are working full time, to still be, you know, the full moms, you know, the cook, you know, make sure the house is in order. And so women have a lot of time constraints, and they know about that. And so they might be like, oh, maybe I don't want to have kids because I'm not going to quit my job. I'm not going to leave. I'm not going to become a stay-at-home mom. And the other thing is that increasingly, and this goes to, you know, a broader societal perspective, is that oftentimes and increasingly people want to be married to people who are very similar to them in terms of, you know, economic status, education, and even political beliefs. And so maybe these sorts of social divides, and there's almost a mismatch of people want to find people who are very similar to them to get married. In the past, people are much more likely to be like, oh, you know, I have a college degree. I'm okay with marrying somebody with a high school degree. I vote Republican. My partner votes Democrat. That's going to be fine. And nowadays, people really value marrying people who are very similar to themselves.
Were you able in your research to get down to determining how much this change in children born out of wedlock is to parents who are together versus not together in terms of, well, we know that more children are born to unmarried parents. Do we know how many of those unmarried parents are in a committed relationship where they share a household versus single parents who are not together at the time of the birth?
Yeah, and I think the data would simply put that most of this shift, you know, these big increases that we've seen in kids being born out of marriage, they're essentially, those kids are being born to parents who are living together, cohabitating, you know, are in a committed relationship. And so you can make an argument, it's like, well, does this, you can make maybe some larger implications about why this matters. But in general, like, if the kid still has two parents in their life, you know, both parents are working, both kids are able to help out, you know, take them to soccer practice or whatever, are kids really harmed if they still have two parents in their life, even if their parents aren't married?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we have to keep coming back to the whole social pressures, because a few generations ago, someone was literally, I mean, you talked about the shotgun wedding. People were literally blackballed in society if they had children out of wedlock. Someone texted us earlier and says, so what you're telling me is that a majority of children born in Louisiana now are bastards. Well, we don't even use that term anymore. But just a couple of generations ago, someone who was labeled a bastard because they were born to parents who weren't married faced a much tougher row in life and would be ostracized and called out for nothing of their fault other than the fact that their parents didn't get married before they were born. The society seems to be far more accepting of that now.
I think that's true, is that I think more people, you know, whether or not just because someone in their own family, you know, maybe they have a brother and sister who had kids out of marriage, you know, their own kids had kids out of marriage, you almost have to accept, you know, your own family doing this sort of thing. And I think a lot of people are also realizing that, you know, maybe in the past, there was a lot of people who were married who were unhappy. Amongst, you know, younger generations of people, we're seeing divorce rates go down. And that's also because, you know, people, if they're not married, they can't get divorced. And so therefore, people are like, well, I don't want to get married, you know, in 5-10 years, realize I'm with the wrong person and I already have a kid. So maybe we'll still have a kid and we'll just not get married because they're afraid of getting divorced.
Yeah, and a lot of people are texting us about that aspect, and I think that that's significant. One person says, marriage is grand, divorce is 20 grand. Somebody else says they don't get married because they don't want to get divorced. But I will caution folks who, if they believe that that's a reason not to get married, when you break up, if you have children, you still have to have a custody case. There are still assignments of child support, and there is still a lengthy, ugly, and awfully expensive court process that takes place, whether you get married or not, if there are children involved.
Yeah, I think that's true, is that, you know, people try to calculate these things ahead of time with the cost of marriage, with the cost of raising a kid, what's the cost of getting divorced. And, you know, people might try to find some quick answers online or, you know, try to make some estimates, but it's really unknown. And people assume the cost of these sorts of things, and then they make decisions on them, even if, you know, they can't, you know, perfectly predict the future for themselves.
Based on your research and your findings, do you see this trend continuing to a point where we're going to see even larger numbers and percentages of children that are born to unmarried parents in the United States? It's already a majority in rural areas. It's already a majority in states like Louisiana. Do you expect that trend to continue?
I think that's true. There is, you know, other countries, you know, countries in Europe, you know, other high income countries. This has also been the trend where it's been going on up. I don't, you know, I don't want to stake put money on the line, but I really don't think that we'll ever hit a point where it's, you know, 90 or 100% of kids. But I think at least for the foreseeable, you know, next few years, maybe the next 10 years, we'll still see this increase. We might hit some sort of cap because there's still a lot of people who are only going to have kids when they're married. But I don't see a scenario where this, you know, goes back down. This is not like a 1 or 2 year blip.
Yeah, someone else pointed out that when you consider, and when we talk about the rural families, it used to be in rural settings that most families were farmers, that they were raising livestock or growing crops and would have many children to assist in that process. And they were married by and large. Now rural families are having fewer children, and many of the people are unmarried when they have those children.
Yeah, I think that's true, is that we imagine, you know, rural America as being this, you know, place where people have a lot of family, a lot of kids, families look very traditional, there's a lot of family norms, and, you know, maybe that's not true. We're seeing a lot more of rural families start to look a lot more like urban families, and as I've said, as you said several times, Dave, we're seeing even this way that we imagine something that's much more urban, you know, people having kids outside of marriage, is actually even now more common in rural areas. So it's definitely this big social shift that's happening in rural areas. And it also, you know, our research will clearly show this has to do with, you know, declining economic security for so many people in rural America.
Talking with Matt Brooks, assistant professor of sociology at Florida State University, co-author of a study that finds across rural America and Canada, a majority of children are now born to unmarried parents. And the CDC tells us that a majority of children born in Louisiana are born to unmarried parents. Anything else from your research that you think our listeners would find interesting?
I think the only other little facet that we haven't touched on is that your listeners might think like, oh, this has to do with the reclining religiosity. And actually, that's not really true. Is we actually find that America, specifically rural America, is still much more religious than many of our other, you know, counterparts. And so because Americans stay, you know, much more religious on average than compared to, you know, other countries, we're seeing maybe a preventing of this even further increase in non-marital births, right? So America, because we remain religious and because so many people in rural America remain religious, they go to church, that's almost, you know, protection against, like, you know, even greater trends in non-marital births.
That's interesting. So even in areas where religion is still strong, where we're still seeing a large percentage of people attending organized religious services, we're also seeing increases in the number of children born to unmarried parents.
Yeah, this is definitely something where in all regions of the United States, we find this to be true amongst all racial groups. It's true. But again, areas that have higher religiosity and people that report going to church more often per week are still much less likely to have a child outside of marriage. So religion is almost, there's a lot, you know, this is a complex topic, but religion might be this one protective factor that's still occurring.
All right, well, we also had a report today that declines in organized religion have at least leveled off, where we were seeing steep declines in recent years. Most recently, we've seen people attending religious congregations has leveled off to a point where the declines are not as dramatic now. So maybe we will see also the percentage of unmarried parents having children level off as well. I guess only time will tell. Professor Brooks, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your research with us here on WWL.
Oh, thank you for having me. Have a good day.
You too. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. I've got a few minutes for you now to sound off. I want to know what you think. Do you think that our country's going to hell? Our state is going to hell because a majority of children in Louisiana now are born to unmarried parents. Does it portend for a horrible, terrible, no good, very bad future for our state? Would it be better if parents were married when they had kids? Texts are coming in on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. In response to these new statistics that show that a majority of children in Louisiana, nearly 55%, are now born to parents who are not married. It's normal now for parents to be not married when they have a child versus parents who are married. One person texts us and says, I don't believe marriage makes better parents. It just happens that better parents get married. And someone else says, having a child out of wedlock is not sending anyone to hell. Somebody else says it is a sign of a moral decline in our society. Parents should be married before they have children. We can continue the conversation, but right now I want to welcome in Melanie Talia, CEO of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation, to talk about how we can adopt a cop during Mardi Gras. Hey, Melanie, thanks for joining us here on WWL. Melanie, can you hear us? All right. Well, let's put Melanie on hold and see if we can reestablish that connection, because we'd rather hear her talking than dinging. Another text comes in on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talking Text Line, says, we are definitely all going to hell. There is no doubt. The decline in moral society is clear, and it's unfortunate. Someone else says, half the country loves and worships, so that should be recognized, and half the country is still having children after they are married. Well, not quite half, in Louisiana anyway. Only 45% of children born in Louisiana now are born to married parents. A lot of other people say that it's all about finances and it's all about tax benefits and that it's about the fact that perhaps people are getting food stamps, medical coverage, and earned income tax credit because they are staying single rather than getting married, and it would cost them too much to get married. And they'd lose a lot of those benefits, so they'd rather have children without being married. Other people say it's too expensive to get divorced, so don't get married, but people still want children. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on WWL. Now let's go live to Melanie Talia, CEO of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation, to talk about how you can adopt a cop during Mardi Gras. Hey, Melanie, how are you?
I'm well. I'm well this morning. How you doing?
I'm doing well. What does that mean to adopt a cop during the carnival celebration?
Well, it gives the community and the parade goers and the revelers an opportunity to help us support all of the law enforcement officers and all of the first responders who are out there on the parade route for hundreds of hours, making sure we all enjoy a safe and happy carnival season.
All right. I've seen adopt-a-road programs where you pick up litter. I've seen adopt-an-animal programs where you send in money that helps feed and house animals that are in need of such things. I can't imagine that I'm adopting a cop quite along those same lines of either of those programs.
Well, it is very similar. We do ask for donations. We ask for as little as $10. And, you know, for the greatest free show on earth, throwing in $10 is something most folks can manage. So we do ask for a minimum donation of at least $10. Of course, we're happy to take more. And with those funds raised, we provide hydration and snacks, sometimes more substantial meals for the officers and that are along the parade route. You know, they're standing there hundreds of hours, they're on their feet, They're moving barricades. They're taking care of lost children. And look, we parades roll and they don't stop. The officers don't get a break. They don't get a chance to sit down and have a bite to eat or you know, a cold drink. So we need to take care of them while they're on their feet working.
All right. So the money that folks donate goes to that truck that we see moving down the parade route before the parade, handing out food and drinks and other things to the police officers and other first responders along the route so that they can have the sustenance they need to keep doing the job that they're doing.
Absolutely. That is 100% correct. It does outfit the food truck. Or the coffee truck, as we like to call it. But then we also have stations along the parade route for folks who, you know, because the truck only passes once or twice because we have to keep the parade rolling. So we also have stations along the route where officers can go and get something should they need it.
All right. So if someone wants to adopt a cop and help out feeding and hydrating and helping out the first responders who are keeping us all safe and keeping some level of organization to Mardi Gras, where do they go and what do they do?
They go to our website, which is NOPJF.org. It's the initials of the Police Foundation, New Orleans Police Justice Foundation, NOPJF.org/donate. And there in the drop-down menu, you'll see Adopt a Cop. It's really, really easy.
All right. So, folks, if you want to help out and make sure that these officers and other first responders who are working so hard to keep the carnival celebration going smoothly and safely, go to NOPJF.org/donate and you can adopt a cop. Melanie, how are efforts going not only for this program, but clearly we know that we have some of the lowest levels of police officers in NOPD history. How are efforts going for the Police and Justice Foundation to recruit new officers and to grow the force as well?
Well, Tommy, I'm sorry, Dave.
It's all right. Dave, I'm filling in for Tommy, so it's understandable.
I appreciate that. The surrounding communities and cities, as well as the federal, the state, and local law enforcement, have really all stepped up to make sure that Mardi Gras is manned fully and to the greatest extent possible, because we want to make sure we have a safe, happy, wonderful 2025, particularly in light of a rough start. But New Orleans is a resilient town. We are a resilient people. We are bouncing back, and we're bouncing back strong. And that's true for our New Orleans Police Department. And shout out to all of the law enforcement agencies and first responders, again, at the federal, state, and local levels, who have come to New Orleans to help us.
Melanie, thank you so much. Have a great rest of the Mardi Gras season, and let's hope a lot of people will donate to help make sure that they can adopt a cop and help out with this cause. Have a great, great day.
There'd be no purple, green, and gold without the blue, Dave.
There you go. All four are necessary. Melanie Talia, CEO of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation. I'll be back with more of your texts on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. And we'll check in with Newell Norman, see what he's got coming up on WWL.